Hello, UI hackers. Thanks a lot for joining us for another episode of the Hacking UI podcast, where we talk about design, development, and entrepreneurship. I'm Sagi Schreiber.
And I'm David Zintner.
We're your hosts, and today Noam List will be joining us as a guest host.
And just before we begin, we want to say thanks to WooCommerce for sponsoring this episode. WooCommerce is one of the most popular e-commerce platforms in the world. It's totally free, easy to customize, and full of great features. It allows you to start selling and making money on your WordPress website in less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, thanks a lot, WooCommerce. And by the way, if you choose to buy any other paid extensions or themes, you can get 30% off with the code HackingUI at checkout. Again, that's HackingUI in one word at checkout.
Cool. Okay, we have another great guest for you this week for the Scaling a Design Team series. She's the Director of Experience Design at one of the few companies in the world that is truly disrupting an industry. If you travel, you've almost definitely used this product, which she's been working on for the past 2.5 years.
In this great conversation, we discuss managing designers as a design experiment, how craft and hustle go together, and why the user experience should be important to every employee.
Ladies and gents, it's our pleasure to introduce Katie Dill, Director of Experience Design at Airbnb.
Let's get hacking! Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Hacking UI podcast, Scaling a Design Team. I'm thrilled to have you here, and today we have an awesome guest, Katie Dill. Katie, what's up?
Hey guys, how's it going? Good to be here.
All good. And it's awesome to have you here on the show. We've been waiting a long time to have this conversation with you because we admire Airbnb. And, you know, I heard you on like in a professional panel in last November in San Fran, and it was just like you really kind of connected to everything you said there, and I really wanted to follow up on that. So it's great to have you on the
awesome.
Show.
Awesome. It's nice of you to say. Great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure. And today, David is not here with me, but with me is Noam List, our senior product designer at SimilarWeb. Noam?
Hey, good to be back.
And so where should we start? So Katie, how about you tell us a bit about yourself, like just like a very short kind of like background of how you came to be a designer and about your career path up to the point you are now.
For sure. I can't say it's going to be super easy to make it super short, but I'll do my best. I'll give the condensed version. So I'm from New York originally, the suburbs just outside the city. Where I grew up, I don't think I ever heard of product design. It's way after graduating college. You know, maybe interior design was probably all people really knew of design out there. So I studied history in undergrad, and after leaving college and learning about history, I became very interested in architecture and started exploring a career path in architecture. And along that journey, I think learning more and more about it, realizing that, well, I'm probably far too impatient to be an architect. It could take many years to see the work that you create built, and I was looking for slightly more instant gratification. And around that time, a friend of mine saw a show called Making the Shopping Cart. It was on 60 Minutes about IDEO's design process, where they were reinventing the shopping cart. And that, I didn't even see it. My friend saw it and said that that was something that I seemed to be, you know, naturally fit for, because she knew about the little inventions I made around the apartment. And I explored this idea of product design based on that. Realized it was just the dream job that I, you know, was always looking for, just didn't know existed. And so started to dig into that and asked around, how do I get into it? And the recommendation from folks in the field was to go to school for it, because I had no design background whatsoever. And so I applied to a design school in California called Art Center College of Design, and I studied industrial design. So I learned how to make physical things. Now most of my design work is, you know, digital, or in fact, in many ways, it's a service that doesn't even have any physical instantiation. But the learnings from the industrial design program certainly were applicable for, you know, designing in really any media.
Yeah, of course.
That's my bad.
Cool. And so after school, like, what was your like first job, and how do you, like, where did you work up to Airbnb?
So after design school, I went to Fog Design in San Francisco, and I joined there as a design analyst, which is a position they don't have anymore. They renamed it, essentially, and it became an interaction designer. But at the time, design analyst was a well-suited role for me because, you know, I had background in physical design, but I was very, you know, interested and excited about the research phase and the concepting phase and kind of the development of the idea from start to finish. And so I was interested in more of the design process than simply, you know, just the execution of the physical. And so that role was well suited for me. It also helped me get closer to the strategy part of the conversation. We did have strategists on staff at Frog. And so we were helping essentially Fortune 50s with their product strategy, the roadmap, their brand. And I was there for 5 years, left Frog as a creative director, and went to a company called Green Start, which is like a venture capital firm, but of a very different nature. We invested in startups with design services and received equity in return. And there we were basically doing the same thing I was doing at Frog, where, you know, helping a company with its brand and its product strategy and its user experience. But all these companies were early stage startups. So it was like bringing design in at the ground level and in many cases coaching them and helping them build out their design teams and, you know, leverage and think about using design and design practices like user research and ethnographic research in what they were doing on a day-to-day basis. And then from there, I contracted with startups for a little while and then found Airbnb and have been at Airbnb for about 2 years and some change.
Cool. Exciting time. Like 2 years is a long time in the startup world, especially with Airbnb growing so fast, right?
Yes. We often joke that, you know, like 2 years is like 7 years in Airbnb days because so much happens, like so much changes and, you know, the team grows and we're working on so many different things. It's really exciting how much can happen in a year.
How big was Airbnb when you joined compared to now?
It's a good question. I think it's pretty much doubled in size. My team in particular has more than quadrupled. And, you know, let's see, it was about 10 people when I started. And actually now it's about 60 user experience designers.
Wow. 60 yeah. user experience yeah. designers in Airbnb. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there's just so much that we work on. I mean, sometimes, you know, yeah, when you think about it, it's like, oh, like, what are all these people doing? But we've got the host side. We've got the guest side. We design our own internal tools. So for all the customer service agents, they're using Airbnb made tools. But we have, you know, every platform we're addressing. And as we are obviously global, but much of our mission is based on our being global and being truly local. We really need to up our game and how do we function in other parts of the world? And other parts of the world are different. Every city is different. And we have to understand what those differences are and design for that, you know, and find, you know, what might be the universals. Like, you know, hospitality is hospitality everywhere. But certainly, you know, some places have zip codes and some don't. Some use credit cards and some don't. And so we have to address that in our interface and the service that we provide.
Yeah, for sure. And like, are some of the designers located as well, like, you know, abroad in faraway places where the culture might be different?
We have folks that are based outside of San Francisco, only a small few right now, but we're always exploring and thinking about how better to get closer to our users around the world. We travel a lot in the meantime to make that happen. I think one thing that we're still working on is we're still really young, right? We're, you know, still kind of figuring it out and trying to increase the quality and the cohesion of our product. And so while we're doing that, it's really helpful to have people here together in San Francisco. So we only have a few. We have a few in Portland and a few other outside of the world, outside of the United States. But we definitely will be seeing more of that, I think, in the future.
Cool. And I love also that you come with the approach that we're still young and still learning because Airbnb is so already like really established and really well known. So it's very nice that you come with the approach to, you have so much to learn. You know, it's like, I guess it's something that, you know, that's what keeps you so innovative all the time.
Oh, well, thanks for saying so. And yes, absolutely. You know, we often joke that, you know, especially if you visit our office, like our office is lovely and like there's people everywhere and it's humming and it feels like, you know, oh, like stuff is on track. But it's like, you know, we're a startup in big companies' clothing. You know, we have yet to figure it all out. And, you know, we're certainly, we're doing a good job of it, I think. And every day we get better at what we do, which I think is a huge example of, you know, being on the right track. But like certainly every day is a new day for us. And, you know, we haven't been here before. And so we do have to have an entrepreneurial spirit about it and recognize the fact that, like, you know, we're carving new ground every day.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right. So let's jump into, you know, you're talking like, you know, in the terms of we. So who is this we? How are you guys structured? How are the teams structured in terms of product development, such and such?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a couple ways you could slice it. So one, there's the design team, and we actually have a fun name for it. We call it EPIC. Actually was an acronym because originally the four parts of the design team, EPIC, was experience design, which is my team, production design, insights, which is user research, and content strategy. Since then, we've actually renamed two of those teams. So production is no longer called production. It's called design ops because it includes other groups like tools, you know, a team that is focused on creating the tools that actually amplify and increase the speed and productivity and quality of the design and development process, mm-hmm. as well as production design. And then Insights is now called Research. But the acronym is so good, we kept it. So we're still called EPIC. And so that's the design team. And that's a group of about 120 or so folks that cover all those four bases. But what we, you know, while we're a family and we look to, you know, build cohesion between that group and we spend time together every week, we are best utilized and work most often among product managers and engineers, et cetera. So we are an integrated team as opposed to what some folks have as maybe a more like centralized design team. Mm-hmm. We are integrated and dispersed among the product folks. So your product folks, your designers, your engineers, data scientists, researchers are all working on multidisciplinary teams, and they all work essentially from start to finish through the process. We in all cases, try to avoid a waterfall approach. Yep. So you have researchers and designers and products working on strategy, working on the concepting, all the way down to execution. And the way those teams are organized are based on our, you know, our core pillars of our business. We have OKRs that drive our thinking and our, you know, prioritization. So there's objectives and key results for every area of the business. And so we have folks that are focused on the guest experience. We have folks that are focused on growth of our guest community, focused on the host community, building tools and systems for our hosts. We have folks that are internally focused, develop tools for our customer service agents. And by dividing it up among these core areas, it helps us to develop expertise in that area. So, for example, the people that are focused on the host experience, they think inside and out about the host experience, and they know, you know, every which way our product is sliced, that how it helps our hosts or even how it holds them back. But we also do seek to have, you know, some mobility and flexibility. And so someone might be on the host team, let's say, for 6 months, and then they'll move over to the guest team. Like, there's not like a strong in line between them that you can't cross, but there is, you know, a little bit of a kind of a focused areas around them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it totally makes sense. And also that's in a much smaller version. That's how we work here at SimilarWeb. We have just product teams. And like we have the design team and the designers are inside like a product team, like a multidisciplinary team of product manager and developers. We have no US researchers yet, but maybe one day.
None. Do you do the research on your own? How do you gain insight about what the problem is you're trying to solve?
So basically, mostly the PMs do this. We have a strategy team that I guess like the PMs are kind of in charge of doing this research alongside with the strategy team and using us as the designers to be part of the process of this research.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy team is like the one that you can call like a UX researcher for in terms of functionality, because they talk to support, they talk to clients, they talk to, they create roadmaps, they create user journey maps, they create personas and use cases. And they're really kind of like the heart of the product team. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's good. Because, you know, I mean, it is true. So you don't really need to have somebody that's actually called that as long as, you know, the work is happening. You know, I think even like when I was working with early stage startups, for example, it's like, oh, well, we can't hire a designer. We can't hire a researcher. It's like, okay, well, like, how do you bring that work into it, even though you might not have that actual person with that title? Because it's more about the work that needs to get done rather than the, you know, individual that owns it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, here it's also like a technology company. And when we came, I was the first designer. And then like everything happened so fast. I was like 2.5 years ago. And then we started scaling. We were like 50 people. Today we are 350 people. And it's like, besides me, there are 6 more designers. So in order, you know, to get designers, I was focusing on hiring product designers, which are kind of like full stack designers. Still haven't got to hiring the UX researchers, because meanwhile, the strategy team started to build up. And we were like, okay, so whose UX responsibility is UX? You know, because everybody does UX in a way. So yeah, anyways, enough talk about SimilarWeb. Let's talk more about Airbnb. So in terms of product, like, who decides on what products you guys, like, let's say what features you build? Who decides? Does it come from the ground up?
It comes pretty much from anywhere. The problem definition and the idea generation can come from anywhere. The prioritization of what we get done in what order and at what time is based on the decisions of the product team. Product managers basically own the roadmap, and they need to make sure that we have a strategy for going forward and that it is going to help us achieve our goals. But they do work together with the data scientists, with the designers and the user researchers and the engineers to identify what is the right path forward. So it really is a collaborative effort. But at the end of the day, if like somebody is going to, you know, hold the roadmap and say, this is what we're doing and make sure that it is, you know, complete and has a true backbone to that strategy, that would be the product managers.
Okay, and great, because my question is, what's the responsibilities and roles of the product designer at Airbnb? Where does he start his responsibilities? Where does she end? Like, where does she pass off the responsibilities?
Product design is at Airbnb a big part of the entire product development process, which, you know, I'm quite proud of that, you know, we do have such a collaborative culture and that design, engineering, product, research, data scientists are leveraged throughout. As I mentioned, we do avoid a waterfall approach.
Yeah.
Because every one of those members, of course, brings a different view to the problem and the solution, and so can offer help along the way.
Sure.
So I would say there really isn't a spot where a designer is or is not or comes off the project. They are involved throughout. So what it would look like in the beginning is, you know, let's say our company has goals of, we need to improve our tools for our hosts. We want to make hosting easy and enjoyable and really productive for our hosts. And then the product managers, engineers, designers will get together and they'll talk about, well, how might we do that? You know, what do we know from our data about where problems are today? What have we heard from our users before? And then we'll start generating ideas and we'll first start looking at like, okay, what are the most important problems? And so we might realize like, okay, right now mobile is under-leveraged. We know mobile is a really big part of their world. What might we do to make mobile better for them? And then we'll start generating ideas. We'll look at those ideas and we'll prioritize them. We might use research to do so and find which of the ideas that we think will have essentially the most bang for the buck in terms of improving the user experience.
Yeah.
And then we will, you know, identify those and proceed by designing out more solutions. And the engineers and product managers are part of that process because there's a lot of ideas that they can bring to the table and there's a lot of back and forth about what is feasible and what's not and, you know, where can we take this idea. And then, you know, we might do some research. We might do some testing with our users based on prototypes that we create to learn more, and then we iterate on it. And then the designers are, you know, even when the design is quote unquote done, there is an ongoing process of revision and iteration and working alongside engineers to continue to improve it. And so, you know, I would say that they really, you know, never come off of it, because even after it shipped, you know, we need to make sure that we are looking after it. If there's new learnings, something that needs to be changed, we can't, you know, just forget about it in the work.
Sure. And by the way, do you find yourself coming back to iterate on a lot of those features, or do you mostly move on to new features?
I think we do come back to stuff, but I do think we don't do it enough. Yeah. We do, you know, of course, like any designer or any, you know, ambitious team, get excited about, you know, what else we can do and what new we can do. And so it is, it's a discipline to have to come back to something and to improve it. Because I think a lot of us could say like, oh, it's not great, we're going to come back to it. And then once it's out there, we're like, well, it's working. So, you know, do we really need to come back to it? And, you know, that's tough. I think, you know, we all are a little disappointed in ourselves when we do potentially neglect something that probably could use another round. You know, hopefully if it's that bad, we will for sure prioritize it and come back to it. But yeah, I got to admit, there's a few things that live out there in the world that I wish, you know, had another go at it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like I can totally understand. I get it. I guess like it's against our human nature to go back. We always look forward, and like also in life, you know, it's like we are, you know, the human species, we always move forward and we don't tend to go back. So also in product, it's the same kind of thing. It's like against our nature to go back to things that we you know, we finished kind of.
Yeah.
So yeah, but and the reason I was asking about that is because I know like Intercom, we were on talk with Emmett Conley, and he said like they are very methodical about this. So they have a methodology that says that, you know, they have like the five principles of product shipment of how they decide to what features to build. And one of those is looking back and iterating on products that they already shipped. So therefore, that's what I'm asking. Maybe you guys have also something written down about that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about when you push stuff or you deliver it, like how often do you do it? Or do you plan to do like short, like a couple week sprints, or you might have bigger features trying to work on that could take a while, like how you decide what to do and how often you can ship stuff?
Yeah, great question. And I would say it's a little bit different for every team and every project. So we're absolutely shipping stuff every day, multiple times a day. And we're putting out new things to the website. Some of them might be, you know, small fixes that you might not even see. And then, of course, sometimes much, much bigger overhauls and new product features. Right. And the same thing for mobile. Of course, with mobile, you know, we have a kind of like repeating cycle. So it's a little bit different as opposed to like daily, but we definitely are constantly making changes. We do have two times in the year where we have kind of key milestones. So in the spring and again in the fall, we have what we call big launches. And in the spring, it's focused on the guest experience. In the fall, it's focused on the host experience. And that is somewhat of like the kind of the drumbeat that helps our entire product team kind of come together around these key milestones. Because a lot of times, the biggest things that we're shipping are, you know, interdependent on many teams. And so having that kind of rallying point for us helps all these teams work better together. So we all know like what is our timeline, but on a, you know, a daily basis, that's just, you know, various teams kind of operating in somewhat autonomous ways to solve for, you know, the particular problem areas within their side of the product. And so therefore, you know, don't necessarily have cohesion across the entire team. Not everybody needs to know about every little thing that's happening, depending on the teams. So again, it just comes about to the scale and the interdependencies of what's being shipped.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I was kind of asking because I was wondering if you do have like long-term projects, like you kind of mentioned, how you keep the team, I guess, focused. I kind of feel that if you do a project that lasts, let's say, more than two or three sprints sometimes, it's easy to get lost and kind of forget where the deadline is. Or at least stay hungry the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of wondering if you have any tips or how you guys do it, maybe if it's like a long-term project.
I guess the biggest thing, you know, really for any type of work, long or short, where it comes down to like, how do people get excited about it and have that drive is about the vision for where it's going. And, you know, we try, and I think there's always places where we can improve on this, but try to connect back every thing that one of the team members is working on to the larger vision of the company. What are we trying to achieve, you know, in the long term? What are we trying to achieve in the short term? And how do all these pieces come together?
Right.
You know, it's such an important part of it because when that starts to break down, you know, when someone's like, oh, I'm, you know, here I am working on, you know, the payment form And, you know, I don't know why I'm, you know, iterating on this and spending, you know, days and weeks working on this thing and to what end. That's a problem. You know, they need to see the purpose and the power of their work and, you know, connecting it back to the larger vision and, you know, what we're seeking out to do helps to give them, you know, a little bit more understanding of why this is so critical.
Right.
And I think that's a huge on a big project where, especially in the early stages, you know, where the end, the finish line can seem so far away. I also, the reality is like you can dream a big vision about changing the product, but usually the best approach to getting there is by taking smaller steps.
Right.
It really depends on what the thing is. But for example, when we design for our hosts, if we were to just like overnight change everything about the product and we're like, oh, look, hosts, we made you a better product, but we changed everything. That is a problem. You know, some of these folks are, you know, building their livelihood on this product. And if they don't know how to use it, even if it is like technically better, that might be a big problem for the business that they're running. And so we have to take a more delicate approach in launching these changes, bring them along with us, help them see the changes that we're making, get feedback, and take a step approach to it, even though that like the larger vision might be, you know, a true overhaul.
Right. Kind of follow up on that. I was wondering how you mentioned you had such large teams, especially like of designers, you have 60 people or whatever, plus the developers, I'm sure it's hundreds. And you do have to kind of keep them, I guess, all involved in the same project and keep them all synced. I was wondering how you do that on such a large scale to keep these people hungry all the time in the loop throughout the whole process.
Yeah, keeping people in the loop is definitely an increasing challenge as the team grows. You know, it was one thing when we were 10 designers sitting side by side, you know, and the engineers were all, you know, within sight distance. But now, you know, we're talking about like hundreds of engineers and, you know, quite a few designers as well. It makes it challenging. And it also is a constantly evolving process to keep people aligned. The ways that we kept them aligned last year are different than the way we need to do it this year. And so there's a couple of things. I think it's about the tools, it's about, you know, the methods, and it's about the culture. One, you know, starting with just like bringing on people into the team that fit the core values and are good communicators and are, you know, going to be great collaborators is like the first and most important thing. You know, we have no chance of working together if, you know, we are hiring, you know, folks that can build into that. And then the process, you know, we need to set up, you know, certain types of meetings or certain types of communications so that there is that. So for example, on the design team, we have what we call a visual stand-up. And so every week the team comes together and everybody shares like one screenshot of what they're working on. And we go around the room and, you know, 60 people say what they're doing and it's done in 30 minutes.
Wow.
And by having a visual alongside of it, they don't need to say much. You know, they can show like, I'm working on the payment form, and people can see, oh, okay, you know, you're doing it that way. You're using like that design style. Okay. You're like impacting, you know, that part of the app and that part of the website. And just by seeing it, they get a lot of the answers that they might need. I mean, they can identify for themselves where the dependencies lie. Like, oh shit, you're working on that. Well, so am I. So we need to talk. And that's a key part of keeping that cohesion. And then lastly, it comes down to the tools. So we just revamped our design system. And now our design system is a component library that, you know, employs our, you know, design styles, but also brings it together in terms of like, how is it used and where, you know, how does the typeface sit with a picture in a certain block that can be reused as a modular piece throughout our app. And that by having that kind of like more, I guess, tool-based system, we can have better cohesion in what we're producing. And also it removes a lot of, I guess, the noise in a typical product design process where at one point we were asking ourselves like, oh, you know, what padding do I use and what grid and what typeface? And those questions shouldn't be, you know, a part of everyday decision. Those should be defined so we can spend our time instead on, you know, bigger questions about the user experience.
Right. And there's a team that does just that. Is in charge of that to make sure that it's always cohesive?
Yes. We have a team, we call it the DLS team, the design language system. And these designers are focused on building, you know, the best design system possible that, you know, not only is going to look great, it's going to work really well, it's going to be accessible, and it's going to be unified across all of the different platforms we design for and help the designers and the engineers move faster and create higher quality work. It is a huge ambition. It is not easy, of course, but the work that these guys have been doing, and the first instantiation of it shipped this past April on the guest side of the app, and we're slowly but surely bringing it to all parts of our product.
That's pretty cool. We're at the ambition stage currently.
Our
team is a guy, and he's working on it pretty hard.
And one of the product designers, that's like his side project inside SimilarWeb to do the style guide.
Right. and the faster we is always we're one step ahead of him, so he has a lot of work to do. Every time he thinks he's done, We design a new drop-down menu, and he has to start from scratch.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've been back and forth here for the last year, thinking whether we should actually try to build a team to do the style guide. So it's something that we're really eager to learn more about. Do you have you have developers also on this team, or is it like only designers?
They work right alongside developers. I mean, that's imperative because it's intentionally not a style guide. It employs styles, but it is actually highly linked to the development. And so when we create a component, we work with the engine, like when we design a component, we work with the engineers for them so that they can create the component in code.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the efficiency is gained. And so there's, you know, a constant back and forth where a designer might say like, oh, let's make the component look like this. And, you know, an engineer can respond with, well, actually it would be better if we did it this way. And so they work really closely on that. And I think that's, you know, imperative for it to be successful.
Yeah, of course. That's, I guess it's a perfect picture of that.
Yeah, it's ideal. You have that if you have that kind of freedom. I was wondering, does that let your designers, I guess, build with code automatically because it's already built components?
That would be the ambition. You know, as soon as we can get there, you know, I think that would gain for a lot of efficiency is that, you know, while a designer is prototyping something that, you know, the code is kind of filling in. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to have production ready code to ship. I mean, there's, you know, a reason for the experts in the engineering team that are going to be able to build something far more robust. But the closer we can get to, you know, that shared language, the better. You know, right now where, you know, design is today is like designers are creating these mocks in one tool that's basically all for show. They're putting red lines on it so that they can translate it to somebody else. You know, what we strive for is to, you know, be able to remove that kind of like level of translation that needs to happen. And, you know, by creating what, you know, the mock or the prototype, you know, you are inherently creating what's going to be communicated to an engineer and they're going to build together. That's absolutely the ambition, but that's, you know, it's a long road to get there.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of the tools aren't ready to take that on. But the good news is, you know, as you look around, you know, what Adobe's doing, what Sketch is doing, what, you know, Origami, like, all of these different tools are absolutely getting hip to the idea that we need to start speaking the same language. And so I'm excited about the changes that are underway.
Right. Because at the end, even if you have a complete style guide built in, like in HTML or CSS, we still have to have all the Sketch files or whatever also synced.
Yeah.
And so anytime we design, we're still not really touching the code. It just helps the developers build it at the end. But yeah, there is, it's kind of missing the step in between.
Yeah. Like Redline's like, you know, the Rosetta Stone. They're like trying to translate what's written. And it's kind of silly, doesn't it?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like it would be such a perfect world if just would be like a live environment. Just like, even just like a prototyping tool, and your prototyping tool based on that style guide to create mocks, and everybody, even the PMs could create mocks, and then like the designers could really focus more on the user experience problems. That would be so much. That would be amazing. So, Katie, do you have like any, you talked about methodology as well. Do you have like any written methodology that all designers follow or are being trained on as they join the team?
I don't have what, you know, like a lot of teams might say, you know, it's like their principles for design and how we all work together. We have more a kind of, I guess, high level agreement on what matters. And, you know, I would say it's like probably every 3 months we explore the idea of like, oh, should we have our principles written down? And the fact of the matter is that like, if we go that route, I'm quite concerned that they're going to look a lot like everybody else's principles of, you know, these like five things of like, oh, we design for users and we care about quality. Like, yep. Those kinds of things are pretty obvious. And I would assume that that is the benchmark and expectations for all of our team members. I think where, you know, the idea of principles becomes really powerful and, you know, what I'm excited to see currently on our team is that we have principles for, you know, how do we design for growth? How do we design for hosts? How do we design for a particular problem area for business travel? And those are the like most powerful kind of guides in our everyday for our team in terms of like, our decision making of like who we hire and, you know, what matters to us. We have the core values of the company, which we all are all believers in and identify well with and use as we think about hiring people. But then beyond that, we look for, you know, certain things in the team. This is the high level principles I was referring to. We look for a high level of craft, humility, and hustle. And those three things, you know, are just a kind of a summary of it all. But your craft has to be excellent. You have to be caring about the details. You have to be thinking in systems. You have to ensure that you are leveraging, you know, the best taste and pushing forward the best user experience. So while you have to be the best at what you do, you can't have an ego about it. You know, we design for people other than ourselves. We design alongside engineers and product managers and researchers. We have to be truly collaborative. So that's where the humility piece comes in.
Yeah.
And then lastly, you know, we have to do it, and we have to do it as quickly as possible, productively and proactively. And so that's where the hustle comes in.
Yeah. So I guess that's a methodology of its own. It's like craft, humility, and hustle. It's something, it's a very strong statement.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So let's get into hiring, because hiring is kind of, you know what, before we get into hiring, so you said you have a pretty much like a, and maybe that will get us into hiring, but so when a new member joins the team, like you hire a new designer, so how do you train the designer for those unwritten principles or methodology that you guys hold? How do you get them into the loop of whatever is going on in such a big design team, such a large scale design team?
Well, it starts certainly before with like, who do we even bring on? So we have a core values as a company. And then beyond that, we do have a framework for thinking about who we hire to the design team. You know, when we were a really small team, it was pretty easy to just kind of talk about what we were looking for and align. But as we grew, we needed to write it down. And so we do have a kind of framework, a recommended set of questions, recommended things to look for, red flags, green flags, etc. So we can identify the people that do have craft, humility, and hustle long before they enter the building. Once they arrive, we do go through an onboarding process. We have a week-long company onboarding process where they meet basically every team within the company and they learn a little bit about everybody, which is really powerful. It's an intense week, but it's a fun week. It's a little bit like camp, and you know, everybody gets to meet all yeah. parts of the business to get better context. And then we have a boot camp, which is a little bit more informal, and you'll have meetings with engineers, you'll have meetings with the various design leaders, with researchers, production designers, so that you can learn about the various parts of most related to design. And so we'll talk about these things like craft, humility, and hustle, and what that looks like. And we'll talk about the expectations. We have a career levels framework that helps people understand what's expected in their level, and then, you know, how they can advance, what their career path looks like. So we try to make sure that people have clarity about, you know, where they're going and what's expected, but it is an ongoing process and certainly not something that is solved by one meeting or one discussion. And it's, you know, a lot of it comes down to the manager and the report's relationship. You know, we try to encourage people to speak up and ask for feedback, but also, you know, remind, you know, and push on our managers to continue to be very active in their people's development.
Yeah, and like the managers in terms of being proactive in so design managers, is there like a system that they work with in terms of, do they have like weekly meetings with each and every designer? Do they have days where they all meet and work together? How do teams like with their managers keep in sync, and how can every employee get, you know, the personal treatment and be set up for success?
Yeah, no, these are really good questions, and I wish I knew all the answers to it, because the reality is like, it's, I mean, it's different for everybody. I mean, this is, in the last 2 years, you know, I have managed a lot of people, and every one of them is different and, you know, has different needs. And, you know, some people are really like lean into their growth and they'll come to a one-on-one. They'll be like, this is what I want to talk about. This is, you know, how I'm growing over here and what I'm doing over there. And then, you know, other folks are far more passive in that conversation, but it certainly doesn't mean that they don't care about their growth. It just means that you have to take a more active part in it. So, you know, it's been a great learning experience for me to think about, you know, that range of need and that, you know, kind of difference in personality as folks, you know, participate in their own growth. And then as a manager of managers, I have to think about how can I encourage other managers to think about these things and, again, you know, be flexible with their approach so that it's best for the different people that they work with, but that they are, you know, participating actively. And we have moments where, you know, somebody doesn't agree with their manager's approach and, you know, isn't fulfilled with what their manager is doing. And so what, you know, I then need to do is investigate, try to understand, you know, is it just a mismatch or is somebody dropping the ball, and, you know, mm-hmm. hold that person accountable if they are not living up to expectations of their role as a manager or even their role as a direct report. And so it's a couple times a year we do performance reviews, and we also, you know, ongoing check in with people about, you know, how things are working and what's not working. We also do company-wide surveys to understand, you know, people's enjoyment and engagement with their job and their manager, which can really inform, you know, where gaps might exist.
Yeah, it's a great answer. And what are your most helpful tips for a new design manager out there?
Tips for a new manager is really being self-aware with how you're showing up and think about how you might leverage your skills as a designer, as an IC, to be a better manager. I think the hardest thing when you go from being an IC to a manager is that you're, you know, this fear of letting go, this fear of, you know, pulling your hands away and trusting in someone else to get it done. And that can be really hard. And in some cases, you know, folks, you know, worry about the loss of their creative ability. But the reality is your ability as an IC is actually something that's going to make you a much stronger manager. You know, designers, we're empathetic and we, you know, seek to understand our users, and you should be bringing that same skill to managing. You know, think about your one-on-ones with your direct reports, like ethnographic studies, you know, conduct mm-hmm. interviews, learn from them, try to understand how they tick and what's wrong and what's not working. You know, designers, we're inherent problem solvers. That's why most of us got into it in the first place. And, you know, there are tons of problems to be solved for a manager and a team leader. So you just have to be thinking about them in the sense that, like, okay, they might not, you know, look the way a problem does on an interface, but it certainly has many of the same attributes where something's not going right. And similarly, you have to ideate and concept and come up with new ideas. And similarly, you can prototype your ideas. So, like when I mentioned our stand-up, like that is another iteration on the way we were trying to solve for alignment within our team. So before that, we had a different type of meeting where, you know, we would just come together and talk. And we started to see that that meeting was falling apart. Like people weren't paying attention. And we took that as a signal of there's a problem here. We need to try something else. And we concepted, come up with other ideas, and then prototyped it. And we tried having everybody, you know, bring in their work printed out. It's like, okay, that doesn't work. That takes too much time. And then we tried another way where, you know, everybody just, you know, put it up on a different type of document, and then we realized, oh, that doesn't work. So now we use Google Slides. So we just kept iterating on it until we found the best way to do it. So I would say, you know, the struggle, but the, like, really imperative mindset shift that will help an IC move to a manager is thinking about managing as a design problem. Think about leading a team as your object of design. Your output is, you know, a highly functioning team, but all of the processes and the, like, methods that you use to design a product are actually very similar to the processes and methods you need to use as a manager.
Yeah. I really love this approach. This is a really, like, refreshing approach on the whole, like, design management thing, because it actually says, hey, designer, you're a manager, so be a designer as a manager.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. I love it.
Also, for anybody that's interested in getting into management, but, you know, hasn't made that leap yet, I would recommend that they look for opportunities to be a teacher or a mentor or an advisor, because those are all going to give you, like, those kinds of challenges about letting go and, you know, being more of a guide rather than, you know, the hands-on doer yourself. I taught early on while I was still at Frog, and it was one of the most challenging things I've ever done, but it was imperative for helping me learn to be a better manager, because you definitely have to use your skills in a different way. And when you have to explain what you're doing as opposed to just going ahead and doing it, you'll challenge yourself, but it'll be a good thing for your management path.
Yeah, totally. I can relate, because I had a few times where I kind of I've done lectures and like a 4-hour class here and there before I became a manager. And I think that kind of helped me out when I became a manager for the first time, because I had no idea whatever I was doing. I was like never managing anyone before. So that's a totally good tip. Noam, you had a question?
Yeah, I hope I phrased this one okay. I'm kind of curious if you have any ideas or tips or guidance you can give to, like in general, how to make your product design career last a long time. Like, I'm pretty sure that not everybody can go into management. Some people just might be amazing designers and don't really want to be in charge of other people, or don't want to have, you know, kind of the bureaucracy of being in management or having people beneath them. And I was just kind of curious, like, how you would... any tips you have, how you can recommend, like, to move forward in your career? If you're already at a point where you're happy, you're a senior product designer, you're doing everything you can, but you want to stay also relevant and employable, you know, 10 years from now.
Oh, good question.
Or 5 years from now.
I mean, who knows what will happen 5 years from now? We might all be out of a job. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I think we're here to stay. Well, one, I think more and more companies are getting hip to this idea, but that, like, management shouldn't be the only path forward. You know, for example, at Frog, as well as here at Airbnb, we have a dual path. There is a IC path that advances to a principal level designer, and then there is a management path that advances to design manager. And both of these, you know, can be the same seniority, and principals don't need to manage people, but instead they are required to up-level the craft. They, you know, where they're not spending time with individuals in their career, they should be advancing the tools that we use. They should be pushing forward our methods. They should be mentoring people to help up-level the craft throughout the company. And those are really powerful participants in our culture, and certainly really powerful in bringing our design to another level. And they, you know, are quite senior, but they're not managing. Right. And that's great. And I think more and more companies have paths like that. It used to be that management was the only way to succeed. And that is an unfortunate reality, because frankly, not everybody wants to manage. Not everybody is a good manager and should not be one. And I think outside of that, though, you know, even while you're focused on the craft, where, you know, design is going is we're a part of more discussions. You know, it used to be like, oh, how can design get a seat at the table? It's like, well, design is at the table now. Right. Maybe not in equal amounts at every company, but absolutely design is far more recognized and appreciated broadly now than it ever has. But to be, you know, to keep that seat at the table and to continue to be valuable, we have to continue to grow our skills in terms of understanding the business, understanding the data behind it, understanding the technology, and help to guide the appropriate strategic decisions for the user experience, but for, you know, how it comes together with all of these other attributes like the technology and the data. And so that, I think, is like lifelong growth. You know, the tools that we use and the abilities that we have are just going to continue to grow. And all designers should be thinking about how they can learn more and be a part of that as they advance.
Right. Absolutely.
Cool. So I want to get into the last part, which is hiring. And it's like, it's kind of, I say the last part, but it can take like a whole new 45 minutes. But we'll talk because hiring is such a kind of like a, I don't know, it's such a big challenge. And I think a lot of the success that you have as a manager also in a design team, especially in a fast scaling startup, is to hire correctly. So what would you say are your top tips for as design managers to hire?
Top tips for design managers, like to hire design managers, or how design managers should hire?
Yeah, how design managers should hire other designers.
Ah, yes. Well, I do think, you know, you need to sit and think about that before you start interviewing, especially if there's more than one person being a part of the interviews and the decisions. It's imperative that your team is aligned on what you're looking for. Otherwise, I think it gets into a really bad behavior of a lot of indecision, which can be tough on the candidate. And also, you know, you go back and forth and maybe you end up making a decision without a true framework for making that decision and are hastily moving forward with something that may not actually be the right thing in the end. So you need to ask yourselves, like, what are we looking for? What is the requirement of this person? What are, you know, the things that they're going to be doing, their roles and the responsibilities? And, you know, think about, you know, what are the things that matter to us? What are deal breakers? What are the things we want to stay away from? And so you articulate that, you agree on that, and then you use that as, you know, a reminder as you're interviewing and you're looking for these things. You're kind of checking them off in your head, like, does this person do this or does this person not do that? And through that process, you know, you'll hopefully find who fits the mark and who doesn't. There will definitely be debate. You know, people will see and feel different things based on their conversations. And so after we go through an interview process, which is basically a day-long activity, they meet with about six people. They'll meet people from the team. They'll meet people from the engineering or product or research, so some cross-disciplinaries. They'll meet with people that are looking specifically for cultural values within the company. Then we'll discuss. We'll come together. We'll have what we call a roundup, where we'll each talk about, you know, what we see, what we saw, and what we felt about that candidate, so that we can make a decision that we all agree upon. And, you know, where they fit and how they fit with the team, and, you know, what the makeup of the current team is really important, is making that decision. You know, because one designer does not fit, you know, all holes. Some designers are a little bit better at the upfront concepting. Some are a little bit better at the visual design. And while we look for designers that do it all from start to finish, concepting all the way to visual, we do need to recognize that some people are going to have superpowers in different places. And so then, you know, my job and, you know, the other managers on the team is to create teams that have a nice balance of skills. So if we have, you know, one person that has a superpower of visual design, and one person has a superpower of interaction design, and one person has a superpower of strategy, they all can do a little bit of everything, but they have those powers. That makes a far more balanced team. And so we also have to consider that a part of the hiring is, you know, making sure that we're bringing that balance, that diversity, and have kind of a better composition in the end.
Right. I was kind of wondering about the hiring process in general, mm-hmm. like what you kind of, I guess, put the candidate through or the different steps he has to go through, stuff like that.
So the hiring process is... it could take, you know, a number of weeks. It can even take months. It depends on, you know, the candidate and the conversations that are being had. But we discussed with them earlier some conversations over the phone to try to understand, you know, what are they looking for? What are their experiences? What is their, you know, personality? And then make a decision as to, you know, do we want to move forward? And we'll review their work. We might give them a design challenge if we don't have enough signal already as to their skills. I'd say most people we give a design challenge to. And then we look at the design challenge as a team, we discuss, and then we bring them in for on-site interviews. Again, these could take a day. They'll meet with several people from the team. They'll meet with other disciplines. And then they will meet with also people that are throughout the company looking for core values. And then we'll discuss and make a decision. Sometimes they'll come back for a second round of interviews, oftentimes depending on the level and also, again, how much signal we have if we're ready to make a decision or not. And by the end of that, they will have an offer and typically a team identified. In some cases, with individuals that are coming onto the team, we'll start them out with a mini project so that, you know, we get a sense of their skills and they can also get a sense of the company and the team and the different things that we do, so we can make sure that we're placing them on the right team for them.
Right. That's cool. Just kind of elaborate on that a bit. Do you ever find that the process can get to be a bit too long? Like you might maybe even lose people because going through whatever 7-8 steps might be a bit too much for some people? Or even if so, could that be maybe something that isn't necessarily an indication of how they'd be in your company? Just it's like making people maybe jump through hoops a bit?
Absolutely. And it is a long process, but I would much rather have a long and diligent process than make the wrong choice. And, you know, if somebody can't go through the process, if their, you know, timeline is too short, you know, that is unfortunate, but I think it's better for them in the long run that we, you know, go through the kind of methods and understanding of their skills and their fit to make sure that we're bringing them on, you know, where they're going to be happy. So we do look for places like, you know, where can we just gain efficiency? But the last thing we want to do is like skip steps that would help us get signal as to whether or not they're the right fit. Because, you know, I've definitely made that mistake. You know, we've let people onto the team that weren't the right fit. And it's far, far worse than being slow is making the wrong fit.
Right.
You know, I think the saying is like hire slow, fire fast. Now, I don't know if I necessarily would describe to the whole like fire fast, but I get the idea behind it, which is, you know, like don't prolong those decisions when you have somebody, you know, that isn't a right fit, but do take the time to understand their fit before making the choice.
Right. So you find that going through the whole process generally ends up with somebody that you're actually very happy with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. So one last question. You don't like, you might not have an answer for it, but I'll just ask it out. Like, if you had like one interview question that you would have to ask someone who's like applying for a job at Airbnb, what would you ask?
As a designer, or just in any
designer
role?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, it comes back to the things that, you know, kind of drive our team and help, you know, us find the right folks is that, you know, we do look for that craft, humility, and hustle. You know, we look for makers that love what they make. They like to get involved in the problem solving and create, you know, wonderful, usable, highly desirable things, but they do so with that humility. I mean, it's so important for really any product designer, but especially for, you know, an Airbnb designer that is designing for people all over the globe. And we're creating something that happens really in the offline world. You know, our pixels are only a method to achieve an offline interaction between two strangers that sometimes don't speak the same language. And so us like taking ourselves out of the equation and thinking about those end users is imperative to our success. So, you know, we look for that in the folks that approach us or the folks that want to be a part of our team is, you know, show us that great craft, show us that like that care for the details and the excellence of the work and putting that user first. And, you know, that would make us, you know, be so excited about working with someone like that.
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of the question itself, so design applicant comes up to you and you are the interviewer and you have one question only to ask them. What would that question be?
I like this question.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Do you want me to give you my example?
Okay, you can. Yeah, I'm thinking. Yeah, go ahead.
So my example for this would be, I ask the person, so in your last company, what is the one thing that you did, that you designed alongside with another person that you're really proud of, and you can tell me about that experience. And from that answer, I will also know if the person did something interesting, if he is a collaborative person that likes to work with people, and if he's a thinker. So it's like the kind of couple of things that I can get out of that answer.
You never asked me that.
That is a really good one. And that's a great, I was literally trying to figure out a way to put something like that into words. Like, what's the best way? Because it's true. You do. You need them to talk about their work to understand, like, do they, like, how do they rationalize their decisions? Like, how do they make the decisions? Because it's not important to know whether or not, like, the output was, like, the right thing. It's like, how did they get there? Can they do it again? That's a great question. Yeah, no, I think you said it right. You know, the other one I always like to ask and I always start with is like, tell me about yourself. And it's so open. And, you know, usually people look at me like, what do you want to know? But I really want to know how they choose to answer that question. You know, like, are they just going to like riddle off their resume? You know, are they going to bring a little of their personality into it? You know, what do they prioritize? Like, how good of a story can they tell about who they are? Yeah. But that only is part of it. Obviously, the work needs to be talked about as well. So I like your question very much.
No. It's also a very good thing to ask them, like, tell me about this. Because eventually, us designers, we're storytellers. So it's funny for me to say that because I just like the week ago, I saw, do you know Vooza?
Vooza, no, I don't.
Vooza.com. They're like a studio for like funny videos, a production company for funny videos.
Oh, Vooza. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. So they launched like a video called Everybody's a Storyteller. So I'll just link to it from the show notes, but it's funny. Anyways.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah. So, all right. Noam, you had one last question, right?
Yeah, I had a question. I was just kind of curious, like, when we're working here in Similar Web, a lot of times we're trying to find enough people to talk to or to get feedback from in order to improve our features, what we build, or prioritize what we're going to build or develop. And I was curious, like, what struggles, if at all, or maybe what could be the downside of actually, like, you guys having, I'm assuming, hundreds of millions of users and probably almost unlimited data about how they use your product. What other struggles that might present that we, a small people, wouldn't actually run into in our day-to-day life here?
What are the challenges of having too much data?
Not too much, but very large quantities.
How do you get the qualitative out of the quantitative?
That was a much
better question. Yes. I like it. Really good question. And frankly, yeah, like there's never enough data, you know, of course, like the more we have, the better. But yes, it is difficult sometimes to understand, like, what is noise? What you know, thread do we follow? And so that's one of the reasons why we have data scientists and research on every team and that they're involved in every step of the way. So we might start from a point of data, like, okay, you know, we're watching all of these things and we're seeing that, you know, people are using our app for these five things, but not these six things, or that, you know, in this part of the world, they're using the app more than they are over here. And so we'll pay attention to these kind of like macro trends. But then, you know, when there is like an anomaly, or, you know, we're not seeing the same trend in one place as we are in another, we'll dig in. And then, you know, we'll send out researchers, we'll conduct studies, we'll get a little bit closer to try to understand the why behind what we're seeing. And you know, that's just like an ongoing process of learning. You know, our studies kind of like go hand in hand, like the qualitative and quantitative. And, you know, yes, like I wish we could, you know, double our research team and just be like sending people all over the world at all times, like digging into these things. But, you know, it's not realistic that we would have that big of a team and actually be able to utilize all of that information. So we have to be really strategic with, you know, where we're putting that effort. And that, you know, is really based on the quantitative data. So that answer that question?
I was wondering, because, like, let's say we're checking some new feature or we're changing something for users, and at the end we kind of find out that, let's say, 4% of the people didn't use it as much as we thought they would, and it hurt their experience, but it helped everybody else. So we'd say it's a win situation. It was pretty positive. But in our case, 4% is not your 4%, meaning you could still be affecting, you know, a whole country or a city of users or hosts. Like, how you can take that into consideration every time you do something, that even a small percentage could be a huge difference.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really is important that we understand, like, what that percentage is, right? So it's like, oh, okay, like 4% aren't using this. Like, is that a bad thing? Or is 4% normal? And actually those 4% were never going to use it. And sometimes you just don't know until you really, like, dive into the information.
Right.
So, you know, like, one example is, like, we were worrying about, you know, response time on messages. And then, like, when you dig into the data, it's just like, oh, well, it's 2 a.m. in Berlin, and it's like, you know, 6 p.m. in Shanghai. So, like, there's a reason why the messages aren't happening, like, as often as we want it to. And so we have to address that differently and think about, like, well, how can the design support that? Like, can, you know, when somebody sends their host a message, can we send them back a message saying, like, oh, your host, you know, it's really early at where they are, they might take a while to respond to you.
Right.
And so just, like, try to understand that, like, sometimes, like, bad data or, like, you know, what looked negative isn't negative. It just, you know, needs to be solved for differently.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's the same for the slice.
All right. So, Katie, that just about wraps it out. But I have one last question. When are we going to see an Airbnb bot?
Bot.
Yeah.
Oh, Airbnb bot, like a thing that would help you book? Is that what?
Oh, yeah. On Messenger. Just like, I want an apartment tomorrow in Shanghai.
That's pretty cool. I don't know, but I like it. I mean, we definitely, if you see our, you know, most recent guest experience on the app, there are things that we're doing to be smarter about what we are sharing with you as to options.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be you type in Berlin and you'll see, you know, many listings, and it's just search results. Like, none of them are, you know, catered to you specifically. Now we have built more intelligence into our search. We ask a little bit more information up front, like, are you traveling for business or are you traveling with a family, so that we can give you recommendations that are a better fit for what you're looking for. And we'll tell you a little bit about the neighborhoods and help you better identify, you know, which part of Berlin is best for you. So we're taking steps to that, you know, to have a more intelligent search experience. experience. But yeah, I do love that idea. And, you know, hopefully we'll see it sooner than later.
Cool. Amazing. So anything left that you have to plug before we go?
No, just definitely, you know that we, you know, we are hiring for great designers and design managers and principal designers. Awesome. And so certainly get in touch. And then, you know, we'd love to work with you if you've got great craft, humility, and hustle.
Amazing. And like, is there like a specific URL or link or anything, or just like search for Airbnb careers at Google?
Yeah, you know, ping me on LinkedIn. Certainly it would be a way to get in touch. We don't have our design roles listed on our site today, but you know, you absolutely can find us online or Twitter.
All right, cool. So I can also link to your LinkedIn and Twitter in the show notes for anyone
sure.
who's interested. And great. So Katie, it was amazing to have you. Very insightful. I really loved your approach. So very refreshing views on design management, and I learned a lot. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Very insightful. And I just pinged you on LinkedIn.
Oh, well, awesome. It's so great chatting with you guys. And, you know, I'm excited about the work you guys are doing. And this is a great podcast. So thank you so much for letting me be a part of it.
Thanks so much, Katie. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This week's episode is brought to you by WooCommerce. WooCommerce is the most popular e-commerce platform in the world, powering more than 30% of all online stores. It's completely free to set up and has no monthly fees. All basic functionality is free, and it's certainly more than enough to get you started. As you grow or need customizations, you can buy extensions and plugins, and the community is huge. It's built on WordPress, so getting started is as simple as can be. And what I love most about WooCommerce is that it's open source and fully customizable. You can make your store as unique as you'd like with virtually no limitations. WooCommerce is also perfect for side projects and is one of the tools that we're recommending now to students in the Side Project Accelerator. When I start a project at the beginning, I don't want to waste time. I just want to get something out there quickly. And then as it grows, I can customize and scale it. WooCommerce is perfect because it fits for every stage of the project, and I don't have to waste time changing to another platform later. It's also nice that it integrates with all the major payment gateways, Stripe, PayPal, Amazon, and tons of smaller regional services. And you own your data forever. If you ever decide to leave, there's no risk of losing data or not being able to transfer over your sales information. If you have an online store or are thinking about starting one, check out WooCommerce. Like I said, it's completely free to get started and easy to set up. You have nothing to lose. And if you'd like to purchase any extensions, themes, or plugins for your store, enter the code HackingUI at checkout. You'll get 30% off all your purchases. Again, you don't need to buy anything to get started. It's completely free. But if you want to customize or need some advanced functionality, you have a ton of extensions and plugins to choose from. You'll get 30% off everything with the code HackingUI at checkout.